The headlines. Iran says the new round of talks on the JCPOA revival is focused on finding a mechanism for the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. Yemen says the UN is flying humanitarian supplies into Sana'a Airport temporarily, 1 week after Saudi airstrikes grounded those flights. And China expands lockdowns in northern cities in a race to contain a surge in COVID cases that have reached a 21-month high. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Happening today in Vienna, Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal are holding the second day of fresh negotiations on the revival of the agreement. Tehran says verifying the removal of U.S. sanctions, as well as guarantees that Washington will not abandon the deal again, are at the heart of the conversation during the eighth round that's ongoing. Iran's top negotiator Ali Bagharikani says the two sides do have an agreement in principle, but will not work on practical mechanisms that make that happen. According to the envoy, the talks will also examine the financial and banking sanctions against Iran. Bagharikani says all the participant states have acknowledged the achievements made so far. During the last round, Tehran presented two separate proposals on the removal of U.S. sanctions, as well as Iran's commitments under the JCPOA. Homa Leski joins us now from Vienna to tell us about the latest developments coming out of the Vienna talks. Homa?
If you can hear me, I'm afraid I didn't catch the last part of your sentence, so I wasn't hearing you very clearly. But as you say, this is the, of course, beginning of the eighth round of the Vienna talks aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. And as was announced both by the EU coordinator Enrico Mori yesterday and the Iranian lead negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Mr. Bagharikani, from this day on, from this stage, the expert working groups are going to begin their work on the issues on the table, and the priority now, they say, is sanctions removal. And in the context of sanctions removal, Iran's proposals on verification and guarantees are also going to be up for discussions. Now, of course, these are considered among the main sticking points. We will have to see where negotiations lead in that respect. As Mr. Mora said in the previous round, if 80% of the draft text of a final agreement is done, there's still 20% where disagreements or the main sticking points remain. Iran has said at the beginning of the seventh round and with the introduction of the new Iranian team that's representing the new government that it wants to include some additional proposals, and I think some of them concern the issue of verification and guarantees. When we were speaking to Mr. Bagheri last night after the Joint Commission session, he said what Iran means by verification is that it wants the U.S. to remove the sanctions effectively first, because it was the violator, it was the one who violated the deal and withdrew from the deal back in 2018. So Iran considers this as a logical approach to ask the U.S. to remove effectively the sanctions, after which there will be a verification process that will enable Iran to effectively see the removal of these sanctions on the ground. And only after that, he said, is Iran willing to go back to its nuclear commitments within the framework of the JCPOA. Iran has said that all of the remedial measures that it's taking, all of the nuclear measures that it's currently taking over and beyond its JCPOA obligations are reversible, and it is continuing to say that it is going to reverse all of those measures, but only after the verifiable removal of the sanctions. And also on the issue of guarantees, he was giving us some explanation, saying that what Iran means by this is that it wants to get some tangible guarantees from the other side that it can rely upon, based on which the U.S. would not be able to withdraw again from the JCPOA or to impose sanctions that would be in violation of the JCPOA. These 2 points, Iran says, are very important, because they see this new Iranian team, at least, sees this as some of the weak points that needed to be addressed, and they believe that they are saying that as long as this is the situation, as long as we don't get these guarantees, we don't get this verification that we need, then we're not going to agree to a new agreement or a restored JCPOA just in order to have a deal or just not to pass a specific deadline, etc. Iran is insisting that we're not sticking to any, in their words, artificial deadlines. On the other side, looking at the positions that the Westerners, the three European countries and the US are taking, they keep insisting that this is a matter of urgency, that they want this to be resolved within weeks rather than months. Robert Malley, the US representative representing the Biden administration, in his interviews, has clearly said that if the JCPOA is not restored within weeks, then there will be no point in restoring the deal, and that, in his words, there will be an escalating crisis. And he's even suggested that then maybe there would be a need to negotiate a wholly new agreement. These are all prospects that the Americans have been talking about. But I'll just quickly add here, Carver, that the Iranian sources have been saying that there is this media game at the moment going on. Some attempts that are encouraged, they say, by European representatives in these talks to portray to the media Iran as not being serious or blaming Iran for the failure of the talks if indeed they fail. What they say is that this media story is different from what's going on behind closed doors. These sources say that, in fact, in the process of negotiations, progress is taking place, because in the seventh round, we managed to come up with a common text to work on, which include Iran's proposals. That is, they say, a major step forward. The other participants also confirming that. We'll have to see when it comes to the matter of the content and, you know, the crux of the matter, whether an agreement is actually possible in a matter of weeks.
Indeed, thank you very much for that. Aman Letsky there from Vienna. Many thanks. Moving on to news from Yemen. Yemen's National Salvation Government says the UN's humanitarian flights into the Sana'a airport are back in operation. The aviation authority in Sana'a says UN and other international humanitarian organizations are resuming their flights on a temporary basis. Multiple airstrikes by Saudi-led coalition grounded flights in and out of Sana'a airport last week. Apart from massive aerial bombardments over the past 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition has been blockading Yemen from the sea, land, and air. That has disrupted the flow of vital commercial and humanitarian goods like food, fuel, and medicine. The UN says millions of Yemenis are on the brink of famine. We spoke to a correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif al-Washali. He talked about how the reopening of the airport can help international organizations.
Actually, the closing the airport will absolutely hamper the humanitarian assistance in Yemen, as you know, most of the medicines especially need to be arrived sooner than other goods. They need refrigeration, they need special circumstances to preserve them and to get them to the people in need. Actually, reopening the airport is a good step for the international organizations only, and I believe that they will be using the airport not only for the humanitarian assistance but also for their own flights. And this is what Yemenis demanding, as they don't use it for their flights. They want the humanitarian assistance only to pressure the United Nations and to pressure the other international organizations to force Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on Sana'a airport, to lift the closure on the airport. They want to do something. They want to do any real step or action to move the political solution, and also to push Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on the country, not only on the airport but also on the siege. You know that Saudi Arabia is imposing an all-out blockade on Yemen, and this is the main reason behind the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. It's the blockade, not only the war that the Saudis have launched on the Yemeni people.
Syria says it's containing a blaze that broke out in the western Latakia port this morning following an airstrike by the Israeli military. Footage from local media show firefighters trying to stop the flames spreading in storage facilities. The air raid also damaged residential buildings and public spaces, including hospitals and shops, but there has been no word on any casualties. The Syrian army says that Israel fired the rockets from the Mediterranean Sea. This is the second raid against Latakia this month. The Arab country faces frequent aggression by Israel, usually against its military facilities. Damascus calls these attacks a violation of its sovereignty and has been filing complaints with the United Nations. The Arab League is warning against Israel's new plans to expand settlements in the occupied Golan Heights, calling them null and void. The organization says that Israel must stop its attempts to change the demographic makeup of the territory and its legal status. The Arab League also noted the Golan Heights belong to Syria, and any Israeli settlements there violate international law. The regime is planning to double the number of settlers in Golan by building thousands of new units. Local residents turned out to protest the plan over the weekend. The Syrian residents say that Israel is seeking to forcibly remove them so as to make room for its illegal settlements. Saeed Shahabi is a writer and political analyst who joins us. Well, I mean, looking at this, Saeed Shahabi, we can see how the Arab League perhaps is now much more receptive towards Syria, having Syria in the foray, and obviously, in this case, in point, opposing what Israel is doing. Tell us that aspect of this piece of news, and of course, whether this warning from the Arab League to Israel will really change anything.
Thank you very much. This question of annexation of the Golan Heights is not confined to Syria. It is part of the overall Arab strategy towards Palestine. First of all, is there a strategy to liberate the Holy Land or not? This is number one. Number two, if we go along with the Arab view or the international view that at least the lands occupied in the 1967 wars must be allowed to come under the control of the Palestinians, must not be occupied by the Israelis. Even if we accept that narrative, that is only the part of the 1967 occupied territories are for Palestinians, then Golan Heights is part of that land that were occupied by the Israelis in 1967. Although the Palestinians believe that the whole Palestine, including those lands that were that had been occupied in 1948, belongs to them and does not belong to Israel, and that Israel should not be built or established on Palestinian land. So the position with regard to the Golan Heights, which is being annexed by the Israelis, must be very clear. The stance of rejection by words only is not enough. There should be an Arab plan to force the Israelis to leave the Golan Heights, to hand them over completely to the Syrian government, as they did in the case of the Lebanese territory in the year 2000, and of course as they did with the Sinai that was returned to Egypt. So the Golan Heights, the East Jerusalem, they are all illegally occupied in 1967 aggression by the Israelis on the Arab countries, but the Arab countries unfortunately are not really willing to take a stand, especially after the normalization process that had taken place in the last 2 years, especially between the United Arab Emirates, the government of Bahrain, and the Israelis. So unless the status quo is changed by the Arab countries, the Israelis will find no incentive to give up its annexation of the Golan Heights.
Thank you very much for that, Saeed Shahabi, writer and political analyst from London. The Palestinian prisoner's condition is worsening progressively after being on a hunger strike for months. Hisham Abu Hawash has been refusing to eat for more than 130 days to protest his detention without charge by Israel. The 40-year-old man has lost a lot of weight and is reportedly unable to move and speak normally. Israeli authorities have suspended his administrative detention order because of his critical condition. Abu Hawash is now in a civilian hospital, but his relatives are not allowed to visit him. He is one of among several other hunger-striking Palestinians who are demanding an end to Israel's indefinite detentions without charge. The practice is illegal under international law. Hundreds of thousands more people in northern China will have to stay home as authorities are tightening COVID restrictions. China has already imposed a strict lockdown on 13 million people in the city of Xi'an, which is the new hotspot. And now nearby cities are introducing similar curbs after detecting new cases. There have been more than 200 new cases in the past 24 hours. That's very low compared to infections in Europe and the U.S. But China has a zero COVID strategy owing to tight border restrictions, quarantines, and lockdowns. Thousands of testing centers are now operating in Xi'an to help deal with the resurgence of the virus. U.S. President Joe Biden signs into law a defense policy bill for fiscal year 2022, which allows a rise of about 5% in military spending. The Senate and the House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly in favor of the National Defense Authorization Act earlier this month. The bill allocates $770 billion to military spending. This includes around $7 billion for what the U.S. calls the Pacific Deterrence Initiative. The plan is mainly aimed at supporting Taiwan, which China regards as part of its territory. The budget also envisages $300 million in military aid for Ukraine, which has been a source of tensions between Washington and Moscow. We reached out to author and journalist Eric Wahlberg for comments. He believes the U.S. military spending has little to do with defense.
The military industry, military industrial complex in the States, it really controls the economy. This idea that America's trying to defend Taiwan or Ukraine, these are just pretexts for the profits of the military industrial complex. The U.S. isn't like Russia or Iran, countries that have experienced horrible invasions more than once. No one's invaded the U.S. It's got no enemies. And yet it outspends all of the other countries of the world. It's completely ludicrous. The consequences are the continual erosion of America's health as a viable economy. Instead of producing food and goods for the people, it produces money and it produces arms to kill other people. So it keeps pushing America to the brink. It's a completely insane situation, and just adding more money as a fuel to this bottomless pit.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to English Radio at irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Simple question.
If you're black and living in Britain, you're more likely to die of COVID-19 than someone with white skin. This stark reality has been revealed by research into coronavirus pandemic health disparities, with death rates consistently higher for ethnic minorities. The issue is so serious that the UK's Department of Health and Social Care announced an independent review to find out the cause of potential bias in medical items, such as equipment that measures blood oxygen levels, in different people and different ethnic groups.
Small machines that calculate the amount of oxygen in the bloodstream appear to be less accurate with non-white skin. A report by the Race Disparity Unit, part of the government's Cabinet Office, also discovered that working in roles in higher risk occupations, such as in the front line of the NHS, was another factor that may explain high infection and mortality rates in ethnic minority groups. Healthcare workers, indoor trade, and transport workers in particular were at least twice as likely to test positive for antibodies during the second wave of the pandemic when compared to people employed in other professions, while the security industry also had a significantly higher risk of infection. The outcome can be measured in infections and in deaths. Factors like the job someone does and where they live clearly impact on the risk of death from COVID-19. In addition, the colour of a person's skin creates a two-tier system whereby ethnicity literally affects a person's chances of survival if they fall ill with coronavirus. All of this has been demonstrated very clearly in objective, statistically significant research.
Why has a higher proportion of non-white men and women died of COVID-19 in the UK compared to white-skinned people? And how can it be that the instrumentation itself appears to contain some elements that discriminate against accuracy in relation to ethnic communities? Simple questions with important answers. Now, in the first wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, black African males were almost four times more likely to die of the disease than white males. What does the public think of this? We asked them here in central London. This is what they told us.
Ready? Okay.
We're asking a couple of questions on these statistics in healthcare.
I didn't know this until I researched it.
On this virus, that I don't believe.
Thanks very much.
In the first wave of COVID-19, it turns out that people with non-white skin, and for example, black African men, were four times more likely to die than white men. What do you think about that?
Well, number one, it's very, very unfortunate. It's very sad news to be hearing. I think awareness is a key element of that. And, of course, the cultural backgrounds will play into it naturally. But, of course, awareness is the key element on that, is the key message, and protect yourselves and others.
It's not a good disparity, certainly, and we need to investigate why that's occurring. So is it genetic? Is it lifestyle? Is it, I don't know. It's,
It's sad, but it's quite, you know, possibly genetic, you know, that people realise on looking that there was quite a lot of.
So, I don't know why. Maybe because they are not having the vaccine. It's because of, due to religious reason, that can be the reason why they are dying more than the other group.
I think they're correct. I think a lot of the BAME community, they listen to a lot of stuff on Facebook and believe that than what the government's putting out, which I can understand that side as well. So sort of like a double-edged sword type of thing.
That's kind of expected. We live in a structurally racist society. Depending on the colour of your skin, you may find that you have different opportunities in terms of housing and employment. If you look at a lot of places of employment, black people are predominantly in roles where they continued to need to come into work right through all stages of the pandemic. So they were more exposed, and they probably still are.
I think that's pretty awful, to be honest. I think that something should be definitely done about that. I don't think any minority should be at a disadvantage to anyone else.
I think it's just how we're treated, or like how men from black BAME and backgrounds are treated in, like, whenever they like go to the hospitals, in like kind of the preconceived like judgments that they have. So yeah, I'd probably be saying maybe that's what's kind of attributing to those figures.
In what sense though? Because you can't just say your skin colour. You know, what is it? Dietary requirements? Have they been active? You know, what was gathered to get the answer? That's what I'm saying.
I think if they have got the death numbers by statistics, they are correct. And, you know, the government needs to find why the BAME are more susceptible to this disease rather than the white men, Hispanic men.
John White is a director, broadcaster and political commentator, specialising in geopolitics, political economy and issues related to class and race in British society.
That became a stat that was doing the rounds in society. A lot of people jumped on what I think was the erroneous view that it's because of something innate within black people in terms of their immune system and how they were responding to the virus. I think it's more prosaic. I think it's an issue of class. I think in the UK, well, I don't think I know, in the UK, class is inextricably linked to ethnicity. Black men, Asian men, etc., ethnic minorities in total, they're disproportionately occupy the poorest paid sectors in the workforce, in the economy, in restaurants, in distribution, in cleaners, hospital porters, NHS nurses, etc., etc. So they were more exposed to the virus.
In the second wave of the pandemic, Bangladeshi men, for example, were five times more likely to die than white males. How can this increasing disparity be occurring?
I've no idea. I mean, is there a fear of coming forward for treatment, or I don't know. It's things that we need to look at, certainly.
Maybe, well, it should be something to look into as to why anybody's dying with it. But
it's not anyone doing it for that to happen. I would say it's because of people's background as well, ethnicity background. We're all brought up in a different way.
I'm not sure they're allowed to happen. I think there's ignorance, lack of analysis, lack of data. I think we now know that we could have protected those people better. I think we should have done, but without the data, without the analysis, it's very difficult to do that.
I don't know, the condition of living, I don't know, maybe the white people got more ways to survive on this virus, I don't know. But on this virus, that I don't believe.
Yeah.
Well, I think my understanding is possibly with Bangladeshi men, you might get more of an issue of poverty coming through. I think if you're just talking about people from an ethnic minority background generally, there were a lot of doctors who died.
A contributing factor could be that they tend to occupy multi-generational households, as far as I know. So transmission of the virus was greater amongst those households than it would have been in a less crowded households, fewer people living together.
So there's larger multi-generational households sometimes. If you've got small kids at school, a lot of the time I understand that's been how things have been coming back. So kids get ill at school, they don't know about it necessarily, and then it goes through closer family groups.
I would imagine that if people come in and they're from an immigrant background, that it's much harder to get support from the government. So I just think if it's a statistic that's been recorded, the government should do more about it to help that community.
I mean, it just can't be, you know, Bangladeshi, British, you know, English. There's got to be something behind the scenes. And what is it? I think that's the question.
Can our experts explain the reasons there is such an increased risk of mortality for Bangladeshi and other ethnic groups?
The government's own website reveals that 30% of all Bangladeshi and Pakistani men are in the restaurant distribution sector. So they're more exposed to the virus. And so they're on the front lines, they're key workers. And key workers, absent PPE, which was the case at the start of the virus, the first lockdown, when you remember the PPE scandal, the scramble to get PPE, they were bus drivers, etc., were sent to work without any protection. And they were dying in their droves. So I think the issue really at the bottom is class. It's not ethnic differences, it's class differences.
Dr. Bob Gill is a general practitioner and activist who has been fighting the privatisation of the NHS and has directed, produced and presented the film The Great NHS Heist, which shows just how the US insurance giants are moving in on the NHS.
But there are also the effects of social deprivation, poverty, social inequality, which, you know, will put a chronic stress on people. Now, we know chronic stress has a negative effect on the immune system, and if you have other health conditions as well as a result of deprivation and inequality and poverty, well, that's a toxic combination, a cocktail that unfortunately will have a significant impact on those who are already vulnerable. So there are issues over and above just the exposure risk.
Blood oxygen meters are less accurate for people with non-white skin. Why is medical equipment allowed to be three times more likely to overread the oxygen in the body of a person with non-white skin in comparison to the accuracy achieved with those who do have white skin?
I've no idea, but definitely that's, you know, now that they do know, how much effort is going into making those meters more applicable to all colours of skin.
It's to do with the way it works. It sort of shines through the skin. So it doesn't work with nail varnish on the fingers because I can't remember what it is. It's red light don't get through.
Infrared
light don't get through properly. So, yeah, if it's darker skin, it is going to cause a problem, yeah.
Do you think we should be able to fix this?
Hopefully, yes. We should be able to, you know, it should work on everybody's skin, whatever colour they are.
I've never heard about that one, so it's new. I'm not quite sure why it's not reading on black skin.
Because they haven't been tested across a proper range of the population, and it's to do with the trials of how things are tested. I think you sometimes see similar disparities where drugs companies are unwilling to test drugs on young women. After the thalidomide scandal, they're always worried about pregnancy, so you've seen similar issues there.
If you look at Google, Google reflects society's prejudices, so there's great examples where if you search for unprofessional hair, all Google returns is images of people with black braided hairstyles. That's not unprofessional, it's just basically what our society suggests in lots of documents, and that's what gets fed back to us. Getting the wrong readings on a blood oximeter is the same thing, it's negative feedback from structural racism.
I assume they've probably been built and tested on people who are from a white background. Again, I think in this day and age, probably need to update that quite drastically, because that's just not fair, and it's not an accurate representation of the community anymore.
I don't think that they're updating the kind of medical equipment that they need regularly. So I think these pulse oximeters have been made like from years back, and they're still using those same instruments. And yeah, it just needs to kind of be updated with recent figures to kind of counter all of that in, so that it isn't like inaccurate when it's coming up or when the results are coming out. Yeah.
Well, that's scandalous. I mean, that's something that definitely has to be looked at. And yeah, that could lead to, well, it's already led to, I'm assuming, negative or bad results. So yeah, I mean, that's it's not good.
What has led to a system where the very equipment used to measure blood oxygen levels gives such wrong readings for those with non-white skin? Here are the views of our experts.
It's unfortunate that the pulse oximeters haven't been adjusted to take account for the falsely, you know, good readings that they can sometimes show. And it's down to the design, the use of infrared light to estimate blood oxygen levels. And if you have pigmented skin, then you will get a false reading. But they should, to mitigate that, you know, in the short term, people should have been sent guidelines. Health professionals should have been informed that, you know, don't ignore clinical judgment. You may need to reduce down in your, you know, allow for 5-10% overreading in the oximeter and take that into account. So you might have a patient who looks unwell, but the oximeter is reassuring. Well, if there was widespread knowledge of the false readings, then maybe that would have helped.
In the first wave of the pandemic, the rate of death from COVID-19 for black African males was 3.7 times greater than for white British males, and 2.6 times greater for females. For the Bangladeshi community, it was 3 times higher for males and 1.9 times higher for females. However, in the second wave, starting in September 2020, the differences in COVID-19 mortality for Bangladeshi and Pakistani ethnic backgrounds was even worse. The Bangladeshi group had the highest rate, 5 times higher for men and 4.1 times higher for women, versus the white equivalent statistics. Some of the differences in mortality rates could be explained by the fact that ethnic communities tend to work in higher risk occupations like healthcare, indoor trade and transport. So in that context, are they getting proportionate and fair treatment when it comes to COVID-19?
Well, I only can comment on my own environment there. And there, yes, there is plenty of information, plenty of opportunity, plenty of impetus and attention being paid to it, yes.
Definitely. I mean, now that we're fully aware and we've got all of these statistics that indicate these people are at more risk, then we should be doing more.
It's where I come from in Leeds. It's quite a deprived area and the schools aren't that great, so the sort of moving on to university is not as high as you in sort of other areas.
There's been a lot of encouragement and maybe it's just cultural and the beliefs are not sure, the different areas and that they're not, you know, don't understand exactly.
Just it's rather unfortunate that's happening because most of us are the ones doing the hard work, I would say. So, but well, this is the country we live in, so we just need to continue the work we can do to help the country.
This country is for white people country, and people come from abroad, and they do we do whatever is available to do.
It isn't, but I don't know what you can do about it when the pandemic's just started. You can't immediately rearrange people's jobs. I don't really know what to say about that.
Is it fair or is it not? These people have to work. They have to earn a living, and I think measures have been put in place because of the high incidence of, or the risk factor for these people.
It's not fair anyway, whether it's during a pandemic or not. I think it just comes to light in a pandemic and that's where it gets highlighted, unfortunately. But hopefully with all of this data that you've kind of talked me through, hopefully people can take that on board and do something about it.
Depends what you mean by fairness, because obviously this country has quite a large proportion of ethnic minority groups, more so now than we ever have had. So I'm not surprised that the figures relating to those jobs have gone up much higher.
So with greater risk occupations and racial bias in blood oxygen meters, how well has the government served ethnic communities, many of whom have been in the front line in saving the lives of others while putting themselves at risk?
Do you think the government's given, with all these problems, given enough attention to ethnic communities or us generally in terms of COVID?
No. No.
I think the government, I would say the government is trying, but I think he left things too late, made decision very late for us to get into this stage. I think if things was done earlier, a lot of things could have been avoided, I would say.
Do you think the government really has served ethnic communities in this country effectively over the last 2 years when it comes to COVID?
No. Is a short answer?
Not very well, I don't think. It's been very inconsistent. The advice and the information that we've been given has been quite contradictory. One day we've got this and one day we've got that.
I don't think it's done well. Again, I think there's a lack of data. What they need to do now is, frankly, get their arse in motion, if you excuse me saying so, and make sure this doesn't happen again, and that we now really look at these issues and really address them properly so that our ethnic communities from all different backgrounds feel more looked after and more that we research it more carefully and that we have the real data to make sure we are all equally privileged in this society.
Not well at all. Not well at all. I don't know that they could do anything before they had the answers. Like, when it hit, it just hit. And then you look back and there are obviously massive issues. But I think at the time when it hit, I don't know that there was much they could do about it. And they're short of healthcare workers, so it wasn't that there was a great pool of untapped white healthcare workers who could be drafted in when the pandemic hit.
I mean, I don't know a lot about the exact government policy that's out there at the moment, but what I do know and think now is that they should improve drastically and they should take action immediately to rectify that situation.
I don't think the government's done much, I'll be honest. I feel like they could have done a lot more to kind of, you know, really back the NHS and really, show that, you know, they're acting in the best interest of, like, medical staff and medical assistants. And
I think if there's something that's been discovered or perhaps, you know, that needs to be looked at further, I think the government in general, you know, whether it's healthcare, policing, you know, in general, it's just too slow. I think that's something the government needs to just, you know, it's been really bad during the COVID, and COVID has been used as a mask to make things slower, I think, and worse.
We gave our experts the chance to comment on the extent to which they believe the government has served those from ethnic communities who are literally the frontline team, saving others from coronavirus while risking their own lives in the process.
Well, the government's handling of the pandemic for the whole population has been very bad compared to other countries. They failed to take mitigation. The advice was very confusing. We were getting mixed signals. Now, that had a greater impact on ethnic minorities because of the risks that we've discussed, greater exposure and the higher incidence of chronic illness. So I don't believe the government particularly were negligent towards the ethnic minorities. They were negligent to the whole population. I think this is more of a problem of class, working class and people at the bottom of society being ignored. Their needs ignored, and we haven't had the investment in public health measures. We haven't had the capacity build-up we needed in our health service, and that's affected the whole population, but it's taken a greater toll on ethnic minorities.
Research reveals measuring equipment overestimated oxygen saturation 3.6% of the time in white patients, but for black patients, it overestimated it 12% of the time. This means a built-in racial bias in medical equipment, which very likely has contributed to increased risks of serious illness and death in non-white patients suffering acute effects from COVID-19.
The harsh reality is that members of ethnic communities are much more at risk from COVID-19 in the UK than people who are white. With discrimination built into the medical equipment and the dangers associated with frontline roles, all of this means that if you're not white, you're more likely to die during a pandemic that currently shows no signs of going away any more than that built-in ethnic bias. That's the lethal cost of being black and living in Britain during COVID-19.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity. Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, commander-in-chief, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. Amir al-Mu'mineen, when he was a governor and when he was a leader and he was chosen by people themselves, he was not being in election, he did not force himself into people, he was not appointed by his previous khalif, rather it was the choice of the people collectively, not just four or six, not by one. Even though he was the commander of the faithful appointed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but what can we do when people themselves, they want to be misguided, when people themselves, they wish to suffer? They left him alone, but now they're stuck. So they came to him, they chose him as a khalifa. They chose him as a khalifa, and they knew who Ali is. They knew the justice of Ali. Yet they had the audacity to come to him and they ask him to seek wealth and to do injustice. So they came to him and they asked him to do certain actions that he rejected. And he rejected those who advised him to seek support by doing injustice and inequality to the Muslims for whom he was chosen as a guardian. They wanted him to fight Muawiyah in the same way that Muawiyah fought Imam Ali, by being a treacherous, by being deceiving, by cheating. This is not Ali alayhi salam. That is Muawiyah. That's evil. How could you dare ask Amir al-Mu'mineen to abide by these treacherous ways? Amir al-Mu'mineen rejected alayhi salam. In response to those who objected to his just distribution and wanted more property, referring to Umar's favorism to Arabs over non-Arabs, he said, "By Allah, even if it were my property, I would distribute it equally amongst them. How would it be when the property is theirs?" Now, before the Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, those who preceded him, they divided the wealth based on lineage. They divided the wealth based on whether you're an Arab or non-Arab, based on the fact whether you're a servant or a free man. That's injustice. This is not Islam. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he was asked to divide money and wealth in the same manner that was done before him, he said, "Wallah, even if it was mine, I swear to Allah, if this was money, the money was mine, I would be fair and equal to people, all of them, regardless of their nationality, regardless of their background, regardless of their color. If it was mine, how about when the money is actually theirs? Under what circumstances, under what conditions, under what rule do I have to favor Arabs over non-Arabs?" That's not justice, that's not Islam, and most certainly that is not Ali alayhi salam. So he rejected and he refuted what they offered him by saying something in return. Let us take a break, then we will continue inshallah.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, dear listeners. You are listening to the program For Humanity, and we are looking at justice from the perspective of the commander of the faithful, chief and master, Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salamullah. When he was asked to divide money and obviously distribute it based on the fact there are Arabs and non-Arabs, and Arabs should get bigger, more share than non-Arabs, he refuted their argument by saying, to distribute wealth among those who do not deserve it amounts to squandering the wealth. The Holy Quran also says, do not squander wealth wastefully. The squanderers are indeed Satan's brothers, and Satan is ungrateful to his Lord. So Amir al-Mu'mineen says, if I give my money, or if I divide money unfairly, I'm going to give people more than what they deserve. And when they have more than they deserve, they will waste it. And if they waste it, they will become brothers to the shaitan, because this is what the ayah and the Quran said. So you can see that the justice of Imam Ali alayhi salam, him and the Quran are one. When he talks, when he delivers, when he argues with people, he argues based on the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He is trying to apply the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which makes me wonder, where was the Quran when those who preceded Amir al-Mu'mineen were dividing wealth on their families and on their close relatives? Where were they from the Quran when one of them died, they had to break golden axes from his treasury? Where were they from the Quran when one of them, when he died, he had piles and piles of money and gold? Where were they from the Quran where Muawiyah and his household were giving a massive portion from the Muslim treasury because he was related to one of the successors or the so-called khalifs of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam? This is not me saying. You can pick up any history book and see what has happened. Where were they? Where was the Quran? Where was the teaching of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam? Where was justice? It did not exist. Justice only saw the day of light when Ali alayhi salam was in power. The only time justice flourished when Ali alayhi salam was a governor. Justice only was applied when Ali alayhi salam was a ruler. Now, if you want to see the face of justice, go to Ali alayhi salam. Look at his life, and you cannot miss it. It doesn't matter who you are, a Muslim, non-Muslim, atheist, polytheist, monotheist. When you look at the justice of Ali, you will be amazed. You will be astonished. You will be out of breath, to the point that even Christians wrote many books about Ali alayhi salam and his justice, because he's the only human being after the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa ala that managed to give justice its true value. We leave it here, and we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com www.voiceofthislamic.org/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.